humans to Mars within a decade. Well, before we talk about how to get humans to Mars, how humans can explore Mars, I want to spend a few minutes talking about how humans have explored on the Earth. Because I believe that it's only by looking at how humans have successfully explored the Earth that we can develop intelligent plans for how humans can explore other worlds. This is a photograph of one of the great ships in the history of human exploration of the Earth. Now, she doesn't look like anything that you might call a great ship, okay? She doesn't look like a great ship. She's not very big. If you cut off her mast and bowsprit, you could put this ship inside the space shuttle payload bay, the entire ship. And yet she is one of the great ships of human history. She's the Yoa. She's the ship that Captain Amundsen used to do the first successful Northwest Passage. Now, in many respects, this mission was a lot like the first human mission to Mars. Okay, the duration was 3 years, which is about what the first round trip to Mars is going to take. The size of the crew was 6 people, not 60, not 600, but 6 people, which is about what we're going to have on the first human mission to Mars. And for 2 long Arctic winters, the crew had to live below decks on the Yoa, within living quarters that are actually smaller than those on the space shuttle, let alone those on any trans-Mars habitat that I or anybody at NASA has ever seriously proposed. So in terms of all the human factors challenges associated with the Mars mission, duration, isolation, social space, physical space, they took them all on and passed with flying colors. And that's of some interest, because there's a bunch of people running around right now that say that the human psyche is going to be the weak link in the chain of the piloted Mars mission. I don't believe that's true. If you compare the piloted Mars mission to previous stressful things that people have done, previous generations of explorers, or other tough stuff, such as soldiers in combat, prisoners in prisons, refugees in hiding, you find that the human factors challenge of the piloted Mars mission is comparatively modest. And far from being the weak link in the chain of the piloted Mars mission, the human psyche is likely to be the strongest link in the chain. Well, that's all well and good, but what's so important about all this? Well, the thing that's really interesting about this is that while this was the first successful Northwest Passage, it was by no means the first attempt. In fact, there had been over 100 previous attempts, and they all failed. And the interesting thing is that of those 100 previous attempts, every single one of them was done on a scale at least 10 times bigger than the Amundsen expedition, and in some cases, 100 times bigger, okay, in any measure of mission heft that you might care to define, such as tonnage of the vessel, size of the crews, the amount of money behind the mission, the number of people involved in planning the mission. They were all at least 10 times bigger than Amundsen's, and every one of them failed. In the 19th century alone, the British Navy alone tried 30 times to do the Northwest Passage and failed every time. Okay? And these were not trivial affairs. These, you know, they didn't go into the Arctic with an old sealing boat like Amundsen. No, they went with fleets of steam-powered warships supported by convoys of supply vessels, missions planned years in advance by the largest and most serious planning bureaucracy in the world at that time, the British Admiralty. And they failed every time. Okay? They'd steam into the Arctic, breaking ice, until eventually they'd get frozen in. And then they'd try to winter over, and they would winter over, and they would do that, and they'd eat their way into their supplies that they had brought along, generally several hundred tons of salt pork. And then finally in the spring, they'd generally be able to break out, and they'd make some more progress, and then eventually get frozen in again, and then repeat the process for 2 winters, 3 winters, in one case, actually 5 winters. But eventually the supplies had run out, and they'd have to turn around and make for home. And in most cases, they actually did make it home. But in no case did they actually do the Northwest Passage. Now, Amundsen was frozen in for 2 years on King William Island, which is the island in the Canadian Arctic, in the exact same place, virtually the exact same place, that Sir John Franklin and his 2 steam frigates and 127 men were frozen in on 1847. Now, the Franklin expedition perished to the man. They ate their way through their 300 tons of salt pork, and then they had no food left, and they were still frozen in. So they tried to escape to the south, but they couldn't do it. And they had no mobility, and they dropped in their tracks, man-hauling sledges filled with their valuable possessions. And many of you may, in fact, recall that in the 1980s, Franklin's men were finally dug out of the ice, together with several crates of very fine Victorian china, I might add. Now, the Amundsen expedition was frozen in the same place, for a longer period of time than it took the Franklin expedition to disintegrate. But he and his men did not starve to death on King William Island. No, they got fat. They gained weight. They got fat eating caribou, which abound in the area. Because the Amundsen expedition did not go into the Arctic with 300 tons of salt pork. The little Yoa couldn't have carried it, and he couldn't have afforded it. His expedition was done on private money. It had to be what you might call a pork-free mission. Okay. Rather, what Amundsen did was they went into the Arctic with half a dozen hunting rifles and men who knew how to use them. And they brought something else. They brought dogs and dog sleds and men who knew how to use them, which is an art in itself. And the dog sleds are essential to give you the mobility to hunt the very mobile herds of caribou. And what this combination allowed Amundsen to do was survive by living off the land. And not only survive, but explore. Okay? See, the Amundsen expedition, in the two Arctic summers they were frozen on King William, they didn't spend their time sitting on the deck of the Yoa, staring at the ice, praying for it to break up. No, they spent their Arctic summers roaming hundreds of miles overland, traveling this way and that by dog sled. Hunting, yes, but also exploring. And in consequence, they discovered that the Earth's magnetic poles move. That it is an important discovery in geophysics, and it was made by Amundsen, and it was only possible to be made by Amundsen because of this extremely potent travel light and live off the land approach to exploration that he took. So the moral of the story is that if you look at the history of human exploration of the Earth, it has been shown repeatedly, in fact, that it is possible for a small group of people operating on a shoestring budget to succeed brilliantly in carrying out a program of exploration when numerous others with vastly greater resources behind them had repeatedly failed, provided that the small group makes intelligent use of the resources that are available in the environment they intend to operate in. That's the Amundsen story, that's the Lewis and Clark story, that's the story of dozens of exploration programs that one could go through. So how does this relate to Mars? Well, let's move forward in time a bit. To 1989, President George Bush gets up on the steps of the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., flanked by Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins, the Apollo 11 crew. And he says, "This is the 20th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. That was great. That's what America is all about. And therefore, I, as president, am committing us to go back to the moon and on to Mars, and this time to stay." Great stuff. So he started this program that became known as the Space Exploration Initiative. Well, what happened next? NASA, space agency, went off to conduct a study on how this might be accomplished. And they came back 3 months later with a report, which was called the 90-Day Report. In which they said, "George, we can do it. We can get you to Mars. We will need 30 years to prepare, and we will need a budget of $450 billion. But if you can give us that, we are ready to rock." And this is the sort of thing they proposed. This here is a design for an interplanetary spaceship. I call it the Death Star. It's 100 meters long. It's as big as a football field. It weighs 1,000 tons, which for comparison is about the payload the United States has launched to orbit cumulatively since 1975. Okay? It has 5 big tanks of liquid hydrogen here, each weighing 150 tons. So each of these would have to be launched to orbit separately by a launch vehicle with the capability of a Saturn V moon rocket. That would take about a year, during which time most of the hydrogen would boil away. But we'll put that problem aside, because there are others, such as the need for 2 nuclear rocket engines here, which do not exist, each with 75,000 pounds of thrust, so that this truss here, which would have to be built in space, would have to take a load on it equivalent to a truss standing vertically on the surface of the Earth with 75 cars stacked on top of it. And then here you have the payload. It's kind of complicated. Let's not even talk about it, except to notice that it is behind an aeroshell, about 35 meters in diameter. So that aeroshell is much too big to fit inside the fairing of any launch vehicle that anybody is willing to build. So this would have to be constructed on orbit with all the structural integrity required of an aeroshell that's going to need to hit Mars at Mach 30. And that was the plan. Spend 30 years and $400 billion to build a parallel universe within which one can build Death Star spaceships and sail them off to Mars. Well, that nobody is going to give them $400 billion in 30 years in order to do this. And what we said was, look, what we want to do is we want to form our own team of engineers with a clean sheet of paper charged with coming up with a more practical plan for doing human Mars exploration. And here's the deal. We don't want to have a bunch of managers or marketeers or people like this coming in here and telling us we got to design the mission this way or that way. And because the situation was basically hopeless otherwise, management said, yes, you're on. Do what you can. And so we formed a team of 12 people from the whole huge Martin company, and I was one of them, in charge with coming up with an alternative plan. And it rapidly became clear that one of these three plans, known as the Mars Direct Plan, which I was largely responsible for, along with another fellow named David Baker, that this plan had the most potential for overthrowing the situation. It was the most radical departure with this kind of thinking. And it became very controversial. There were a lot of people both within NASA and the aerospace industry, including even Martin's competitors, that became very enthusiastic for it immediately. There was also intense opposition, very heated and intense opposition. What is the plan? How can we actually send humans to Mars without the need for a parallel universe or a Death Star? Well, one thing that any space plan needs is a launch vehicle. And so we designed one, a heavy lift launch vehicle, which we named the Ares after the Greek name for Mars. The core of the Ares is the shuttle external tank, you know, the big fat tank that sits under the stomach of the shuttle. Okay, and then we have a pod of four space shuttle main engines here. And then we have a hydrogen-oxygen upper stage here with 250,000 pounds of thrust, which is the same amount of thrust we had in the J2 engines that powered the upper stages of the Saturn V. We know how to build one of those. And then on top of this, you have a nice big fat payload fairing, 10 meters in diameter. Okay. Now, people ordinarily rate a launch vehicle by what it can lift to low Earth orbit, or a LEO, L-E-O, low Earth orbit. Okay. And if you want to know, an Ares can lift 120 metric tons to orbit. Okay, that's pretty good. That's much better than a shuttle or a Titan or an Ariane 5 or a Proton, all of which can deliver about 20 tons. It's actually a little less than a Saturn V. The Saturn V moon rocket that we had in the 60s could do 140. Okay, but this is more or less in the Saturn V class. And like the Saturn V, and unlike, for example, the space shuttle, this vehicle has an additional capability. Because it is a staged vehicle, it can use this upper stage to throw payloads far beyond low Earth orbit. It can throw 47 tons on a direct trajectory to Mars, or 59 to the moon. And see, that's how we want to do the mission. Just lift and throw and let it go. Send the payload to the planet using the same upper stage of the same booster that lifted it to orbit in the first place. That's how we've done every real unmanned planetary mission that we've ever flown. That's how we did the Apollo piloted missions to the moon. That's how we've done every mission that has ever gone beyond low Earth orbit. And if we can do the Mars mission that way, with a simple lift and throw strategy, right there, we've gone 90% of the way towards taking the Mars mission out of the science fiction parallel universe future and putting it in our universe of brass tacks engineering. The reason why doing it within 10 years is critical is because what you have to understand is that a humans to Mars mission is basically an embattled entity. So it's like an army on the march through hostile territory subject to ambush at any time. In 1961, John F. Kennedy said that he wanted to have humans on the moon by 1970, and we did. But what if instead he had said that he wanted to have humans on the moon by the year 2000. Okay. Well then, by 1968, perhaps proceeding at that nice leisurely pace, we might have been in the middle of the Mercury one-man capsule flights. But what else will be going on? We're in the Vietnam War. The administration's changed. Nixon is in there. The national mood is totally different from what it had been like in the early 60s. And people would have looked at this program and they would have said, what is this? This makes no sense at all. Why are we doing this? Cancel it. And noted space historians would be going around today saying, ah, yes, this idea of sending people to the moon that someone had back in 1961, obviously it never could have happened. Okay? No. If you want to go to Mars, you cannot do it in 30 years. You cannot do it in 20 years. If you want to go to Mars, you've got to do it in 10 years or less from program start, or you're more or less guaranteeing that the political conditions, the political consensus that allowed you to launch the program will have fallen apart before you ever make it there. So what's the alternative? The alternative is to use the Amundsen approach. Reduce the mass you have to send to Mars by using the mass that is already there. So how does this work in practice on a practical Mars mission? You can launch to Mars every 26 months, roughly every 2 years. In the coming decade, we will actually be able to launch to Mars in 2001, 03, 05, 07, 09. In a given year, year one, 2005, we launch one of these boosters off the Cape, and we use it to throw to Mars an unmanned payload weighing around 40 metric tons. It's unwomaned, too. It's unmanned, unwomaned, and unfueled. And it flies on out to Mars, okay, and it takes 8 months to get there, and then it uses this aeroshell to make friction against the Mars atmosphere to slow it down into orbit around Mars. That's called aerocapture. Okay, and then after we check it out and check out the weather and make sure everything's fine, we commit it seriously into the atmosphere. We use the aeroshell to slow it down to subsonic speeds, and then we pop a parachute and bring it down slow and land it on rockets softly on the surface of Mars, just like we did with the Viking mission in 1976. So now we have a payload landed on Mars. What is this payload that we've landed on Mars? Well, it consists of a number of things, but the primary object is an Earth Return Vehicle, or ERV. Now, what the Earth Return Vehicle is a little rocket ship for taking a crew of four astronauts from Mars back to Earth during a six-month voyage during the final phase of the mission. But no one is in it now. Okay? And then, so here's the cabin with Spartan quarters for a crew of four. And then you have two methane-oxygen chemical rocket stages here, which, as I mentioned, are unfueled. They gotta be unfueled, or this would weigh four times as much as it does. It would be much too heavy for anything like an Ares to throw to Mars. However, in some of the lower stage tanks that are later gonna contain methane, we have around 6 tons of liquid hydrogen, probably in gelled form. And then slung below the vehicle, we have a light truck, like a little pickup truck, that runs on a methane, oxygen, and combustion engine. And sitting in the back of that truck, we've got a little nuclear reactor with a power of 100 kilowatts. Now, 100 kilowatts is like 130 horsepower. It's about the same amount of power that drives a mid-sized car. Okay, so we're not talking about some gigantic nuclear power plant that powers a city here, or even a medium-sized nuclear power plant that powers a submarine. This is just a nice little putt-putt nuke sitting in the back of a truck. Now, what happens is after you land, you will telerobotically drive the truck a few hundred yards away from the landing site, unwinding a cable off the back of it as you go. And when you get a few hundred yards away, you lower the reactor off the truck and put it on the ground, preferably in a crater or a ditch or just on the reverse side of a hill, anything to put a nice-sized chunk of dirt between the reactor and the main landing area. And then you turn the reactor on, and now you got power at the ship. Okay, and what you do then is you go hunting for Martian caribou, otherwise known as carbon dioxide molecules. There's herds of them on Mars. Okay, see, look, Mars has got an atmosphere. It's 95% CO2. We know that for a fact. We know that for a fact from the Viking landers and the Pathfinder lander. Now, carbon dioxide can be reacted with hydrogen in the presence of a catalyst to produce methane, that's CH4, and water, H2O. This is known as the Sabatier reaction. It's been practiced in the chemical industry since the 1890s. It's a very easy reaction to make occur. It's exothermic. It needs no energy. It produces energy, actually. So methane, natural gas, that's wonderful rocket fuel. We'll store that in our tank. That's the fuel to come home. And the water we take and we electrolyze, we split it into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen we store in our other tanks, that's the oxidizer to burn the methane with. And the hydrogen we recycle to react with more carbon dioxide to make more methane and more water and so forth. And then to make additional oxygen, which we can use, we run a third reactor in which we just take in carbon dioxide and split it into carbon monoxide and oxygen. The oxygen we store in our tank, that's useful oxidizer. The carbon monoxide we vent as waste. You can do that on Mars. There is no environmental protection agency there. So, when you're all done, what you've managed to do is take 6 tons of hydrogen from Earth and turn it into 108 tons of methane oxygen bipropellant on the surface of Mars. That is a leverage of 18 to 1. Okay? It's like a pioneer being able to acquire the useful mass of a bison for the transported mass of several bullets and cartridges. Or, if you're a vegetarian, it's like a pioneer being able to acquire the useful mass of a cornfield from the transported mass of a bag of seeds. Take it either way, okay? I'm easy. But it's not practical to use such a vehicle on Mars if you had to bring the fuel from Earth. But if you can make your fuel on Mars, then you can. And you see, and that's important, see? Because what we're saying here is that the ability to make fuel on Mars makes the mission cheap, but it does something else. It makes it effective, okay? And that's critical, because there is no point going to Mars unless you can do something useful when you get there. And the number one requirement to do something useful on Mars in the way of exploration is surface mobility. And that's what you get if you can make your fuels on Mars.